Welcome back to Real World Rewind, a monthly podcast where we take a look at some of our favorite movies from years gone by. I'm your host, Blaine Grimes, and joining me today is Aaron White from the Feelin' Film podcast. Now, Aaron has been somewhat of a regular of late on the Real World Theology Show with Mikey, but this is his first time on Rewind. So, Aaron, thanks for coming on.
Hey, man, thanks for having me. I've been wanting to get together and talk about a movie with you for a while.
Yeah, it's been great because we talk on Facebook and talk in the Real World Theology group, but this is our first time to get to actually talk face-to-face, so really exciting. And this is also a very special episode, for me at least, because I'm kicking off what I hope will be an annual tradition here on Rewind, and that is what I'm calling Spielberg Summers. So every July, as long as this podcast is running, we're going to take a look back at a film from the Spielberg canon every July. And there are a couple of reasons that I want to do this. Number one, in many ways and for many years, the name Spielberg has been synonymous with big summer blockbusters. So for instance, just recently, Aaron, you covered Jaws on Feelin' Film. You guys should listen to that episode. It's really good.
And you
specifically mentioned how Spielberg essentially created the blockbuster movie back in 1975. And so it only seems appropriate to give this fantastic director at least 1 month, at least 1 month out of the year. The second sort of impetus behind Spielberg Summers is simply that I grew up watching classic Spielberg films. So if you've listened to this podcast at all, or if you've listened to me talk on other podcasts at all, you've heard me mention how Jaws and Jurassic Park were some of the first movies that I remember seeing. And I'm talking about when I was 2, 3, 4 years old. I saw these movies as a little kid. And so Spielberg holds a special place in my heart. And I just want to have an excuse to talk about a Spielberg movie on a regular annual basis. So this is my way of doing that. And to jump right in, naturally, Aaron and I are going to kick off this tradition today of Spielberg Summers with a film that was not directed by Steven Spielberg.
And makes sense.
Super 8, right? It totally makes sense. If you want to talk about Spielberg, you start with something other than Spielberg. We're going to talk about Super 8. Now, Super 8 was released in 2011. It was directed and written by J.J. Abrams of Star Wars fame and Lost fame. And it was produced by Brian Burke, who also worked with Abrams on Cloverfield, and it was also produced by Steven Spielberg. So Spielberg is in there, in a way, in more than one way, we will see. And it was shot by Larry Fong, and he usually works with Zack Snyder. So 300, Batman vs. Superman. If you've seen almost anything Zack Snyder's done, you've seen Larry Fong. And it stars Joel Courtney, Elle Fanning, Kyle Chandler, Ryan Lee, Zach Mills, Riley Griffiths, and Gabriel Basso. So that's our cast. Now let's dig into Super 8 by talking about it and how we might even consider this a Steven Spielberg movie, or at least, at the very least, a Steven Spielberg-inspired film. So Aaron, why might it be fair to use this movie to kick off the Spielberg summer tradition? How does Super 8 remind you of classic Spielberg movies?
Well, it reads like a love letter to Spielberg, almost exclusively. I mean, it is from the very beginning. It's a movie that feels like a Steven Spielberg movie. And that's not an accident. It's by design. Abrams has spoken of his love and inspiration of by Spielberg films a lot. And so, I mean, it was done intentionally to be that way. But I think that to answer your first question, as far as why is it fair to kick this off, maybe because this is the closest thing we've gotten to a Steven Spielberg 80s movie since a Steven Spielberg's 80s movie. And in some ways, the new tweaks to it make it better than even some of Steven Spielberg's movies, I would say. So, I mean, you know, there's multiple things right off the bat, from the rural setting. That's something that Spielberg has always been a master of just getting right, in my opinion. He seems to be able to nail that setting and just really encapture how people in the small towns would act, how they would handle things, how they would treat their sheriff. You know, the sheriff is a big deal in this small town. The deputy is a big deal. He's the guy, as he says in one point in the movie, you know, he's like, everybody's looking to me. Like 2,000 people or however many it is, they're all coming to me. Whether they lost a cat or somebody, you know, vandalized their house or they have a broken blender, they always look to the sheriff in these small towns. And that's something that Spielberg's always done, and he's done it well. And then emotionally speaking, this movie... You know, the first half of it is like a coming of age story.
Right.
It really is. And it's just, it's so well done. I almost like it better than the monster half.
Totally.
Or when
agree.
The monster picks up, because it's just, it pulls you in. You know, it drives you in. It makes you feel. It makes you get connected to the characters just like an E.T. did, or just like a Close Encounters does. Just like a Flint in Jaws. You know, there's always an emotional depth to the characters behind Spielberg's work. It's not just about the blockbuster, and that is something that is lacking these days. So those are a few of the reasons. I mean, I could go on and on, because visually speaking, I mean, a lot of the techniques used are intentionally used to pay homage to Spielberg as well. But I mean, it just feels like a Spielberg movie. It really just does.
It does. And I love how you mentioned that you almost enjoy the first half of the movie more than the second half, because so I've seen this movie many, many times. I love this movie. But when I was watching it again to get ready for the show, in fact, I was just watching it earlier today because I've been dealing with a lot of housework and maintenance type stuff. And so I've been behind. And so I was traveling back home today, and I watched Super 8 in a way that I don't really typically enjoy watching movies. And I watched it in a car Blu-ray player.
Oh my goodness.
With my wife. And I haven't done that in years. It was actually a really fun experience, just watching a movie in a car again. I haven't done that since I was probably 10. And I know the movie well enough that I wasn't frustrated by not being able to see things perfectly or the screen being small. But something really interesting happened. We stopped actually about halfway through the movie to gas up and take a break. And I remember after picking back up and starting to watch the movie again, just thinking at one point, I was like, you know, I really like the first half of this movie better. I like the whole thing. But there's something about this first half where the monster's super mysterious and elusive and you know, on the back burner, so to speak, that this movie really draws you in and has an emotional center, an emotional heart. And that's what Spielberg movies do best. So, yeah, it's interesting that you brought that out.
Yeah, not showing the monster, I think, is also another really good technique. I mean, you know, he does the same thing with Jaws, and,
right.
You know, there's lots of history behind that, and kind of by accident that he discovered that technique. But,
yeah.
I mean, he did. And that's one of the brilliant things about this film. I don't think it would be the same movie if we saw the monster in the beginning of the film. I just don't. Like, it would not have the same type of mystery to it. And that's... You hit on that when you say mystery. I mean, that's another Spielberg feeling that this film gives you, is the mystery and the sense of awe. You just have this sense of wonder when you watch a Spielberg film, that there's something magical happening
right.
in this world. And it's awesome to behold.
It is. Actually, if you listen to some of the production team talk about how they designed the monster, they actually designed him so that he would be confusing if you were only able to catch a glimpse of him. You wouldn't know exactly what you were seeing. They intentionally tried to make his design confusing so that they could hold that reveal toward the end of the movie. And I find that I typically tend to enjoy more restrained monster movies in general anyways. Like, for instance, Gareth Edwards' Godzilla. A lot of people complained that, oh, there wasn't enough. I love when a director... when a filmmaker will hold back and not give us the monster till tension is built up anymore. And Spielberg, like you said, kind of almost accidentally by Bruce, their shark not working, initiated this sort of trend of more reserved monster movies. So yeah, in a number of different ways, it, it invokes classic Spielberg. Another thing that's really interesting is, I already mentioned one of the producers, his name is Brian Burke. He was also a producer along with J.J. Abrams with Mark Miller in Cloverfield. So there's a lot of ties between these groups of filmmakers. And actually, J.J. Abrams and Brian Burke knew each other when they were kids. And they were called upon by Spielberg at one point when they were still pretty young to compile Spielberg's collection of 8mm films that he created when he was a little kid and sort of edit them together in a clever way for him, or just to have them all together.
Wow.
So they've worked with each other for a while, and J.J. Abrams got to do that for Spielberg way back when.
That's amazing. That's a neat trivia piece right there.
Another thing that I noticed is the opening of this movie is very Spielberg-y, if I can make that a word.
It should be a word. It really should.
It should. But it's a largely wordless opening scene. It's really focused on showing rather than telling. So if you think back, let's use Jaws since I'm always thinking about Jaws, and you just talked about Jaws not too long ago. The opening scene, it's a lot of glances across a campfire, right? And then this couple, they just kind of run off, say a few words to each other, and then you have this shark attack. But really, there aren't many words spoken. It's pretty silent. I guess there's a lot of screaming going on, but here in Super 8, you've got this camera sort of slowly zooming in and dollying in on this billboard that tells how many days have gone by in this workplace since an accident, and you see this worker come up on a crane and slowly take the numbers off and put one up there. So we know that some sort of accident has happened, and then when we meet our protagonist, Joe Lamb, we see him downtrodden, head down on a swing, and we know that these two things are related, but it's showing rather than telling. Glances tell a lot in this film. Characters, you know, give a sideways glance to one another. Some great performances here. We could talk on and on. We could do an entire show, I think, on ways that this movie, echoes Spielberg, right? Even the monster, the alien, whatever we want to call him, he sounds like the T-Rex in Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You know, in Spielberg, you know, generally he also he's got these alien / monsters that are not always all bad. I mean, Jaws maybe being an aberration or you know, not example of that, but the T-Rex, for example, right? There's the T-Rex is evil, but kind of also has his time in the sun to be the hero,
right?
And you know, E.T. is not evil. You know, our Close Encounters aliens are not here to destroy us. So you know, typical Spielberg films don't necessarily have all out monsters. And I think that this one, you know, the monster's a metaphor in a lot of ways in this film anyway, to what the movie is really about, which is the emotional tragedy that these people have all kind of been dealing with and how they're handling it.
Yeah.
It's manifesting itself now because this monster situation, you know, it's kind of bringing all this stuff to the forefront.
It's a character piece, almost like a character study dressed up as a monster movie, and that's what a lot of Spielberg movies, like you pointed out, are. Also, Michael Giacchino did, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, but he wrote the score. He scored Up. That's the only one I can think of off the top of my head right now. A number of other great things. He's a great composer. But man, does he bring out some sort of John Williams-esque music for this movie. There are some great themes and motifs that we get here that are it's a beautiful score that helps give this movie an emotional center. But let's talk more about this movie in terms of a J.J. Abrams movie. Because if we just talk about this like it's a Spielberg movie, I think we might be doing a little bit of a disservice, or a lot of a disservice, to J.J. Abrams. Because he created a wonderful film. He wrote this film all on his own. And I feel like J.J. is often criticized Or is characterized as a sort of copycat director. So you can even think most recently about the accusations that The Force Awakens was just a remake of A New Hope. That's one example. He's often kind of pushed in there and saying, oh, all he can do is copy what other directors have done. He did that with Star Trek, right? On and on. Is that true? Or does Abrams bring something unique to this sort of kid-centered adventure genre, aside from Lens Flare?
He stole it from me. He stole it. The first, I mean, of course, that's what you got to talk about first. I mean, it's the elephant in the room, right? And can we briefly go there before I get into my real, true Abrams thoughts? So this movie, more than any of his movies and his work, is this is the Lens Flare. This one is the one that's in the museum as far as like how... This is like, this whole movie is Lens Flare.
Yes.
This movie at one point has so much Lens Flare that it blocks out a character while he's speaking.
Yes.
The main character, Charles, one of the main characters, the filmmaker. And at one point, there's an emotional scene between these two kids, and I think it's Alice and Joe that are having this moment, this conversation, and there's like Lens Flare all across the screen. He uses it to the extent that the final shot of this film is a fade out of a Lens Flare. It's unbelievable. And I will admit, I found it a little distracting this time around, the latest time I watched it.
Yeah.
He overuses it. I think he's learned some restraint since Super 8. So I'm happy about that.
Yeah.
Because he does use it. I mean, and there are times to use it. There are times when it's great.
Yeah.
Lens Flare is an awesome technique when used in a timely manner and not overused. But yeah, if Abrams is known for anything first, it's got to be Lens Flare.
Right. No doubt.
But other, you know, when I was thinking about this question and I was watching this, I believe that Abrams' strength is in the storytelling and not necessarily in the directing. And I don't necessarily have the experience to totally correctly say which parts of a movie the director's hands can be seen in. As well, like there, you know, you can tell sometimes when how a scene is framed and stuff. And Abrams does a great job of that, but his strength is in the storytelling. You know, I don't think he directed Cloverfield. He certainly didn't direct 10 Cloverfield Lane. Yeah. There's numerous films that he has had his hands on. There's numerous projects he's had that he's been a part of, the creative team. But from what I remember, like Cloverfield was like an idea that they came up with and they handed off to someone and kind of produced it.
Yeah, it was Martin Miller who directed that.
Yeah, Martin Miller. So his strength is in the creation of these ideas and the storytelling. If nothing, Lost, perfect example of that. Fringe, another great example. I mean, the ideas that come out of this guy's head is what takes me to want to see his films. The way that he handled Star Trek's reboot, it wasn't necessarily the direction that I was drawn to. It was the way that he manufactured a parallel universe to, you know, a different timeline to give us this reboot and make it feel fresh and new and not like a retread and work in things from the past. And he did the same thing with, you know, The Force Awakens. So that's what I feel his strength is. And that's where I feel his strength is in this story. Because he is able to marry the Spielberg-y, since we coined the term, Spielberg-iness of the emotional story and the tragedies that these people have endured and that they're dealing with. He marries that with the monster story that he's so good at telling in just a way that is very rarely seen, if not unrivaled.
That's a really good insight, and it makes me think about one of the things that everybody mentioned, every actor mentioned on the special features. They all said, JJ is really great at laying out a scene in front of you before you shoot and telling you exactly what this character is feeling. And I know every director does that to a certain extent, but everybody raved about how he did that and how he was able – he just had such insight he was able to offer into these characters that he created. So yeah, it seems like – I think you're onto something. Storytelling is definitely his strong suit there. And one component of Super 8 that, or really of any film that I'm always a huge sucker for is if a movie has any sort of meta element, I'm usually into it. So Super 8 is a movie, is framed as a movie about kids who are making movies where something goes horribly awry. That's how Super 8 is framed. A movie about kids making movies. And then stuff goes wrong. And I almost always find meta stories entertaining, even when that aspect of the film or what, or the show or whatever it is, isn't particularly smart or groundbreaking or anything like that. There's just something about that sort of metafictional element that checks my boxes. So, for instance, one of the TV shows that I really enjoy is Castle with Nathan Fillion. And I find that show really entertaining because it's about a mystery writer, Nathan Fillion, who uses his storytelling skills to help solve crimes. So, like I said, the show isn't particularly groundbreaking or particularly brilliant, but that metafictional component makes it really enjoyable for me. I just like that. And that's a large part of the reason I like Super 8 so much, I think. The fact that these kids are making a movie, and from what we can tell from the bits of the movie we see, this movie is about a man who is in some sort of relationship with either his wife or his girlfriend or something like that. And he loses her when she becomes a zombie. And that is a super interesting way for Abrams and for us to be able to work through or see Joe, the character of Joe Land, played by Joel Courtney, see him work through the loss of his mother. And that's something that movies and the other arts can help us with. They can help us process and cope with and sometimes move beyond the tragedies that mark all of our lives. And so by inserting this sort of meta element where you have a kid making a movie, working on a movie that's sort of about that, is a really interesting thing to do, and it works for me. And I know it hits me even on a personal level because I know when I was a little kid, 4 or 5, Spielberg and his films, it's what helped me get through my parents' divorce. And I don't say that in a cliche way at all. I mean, Jaws and Jurassic Park were there for me in a very big way when I had some of those things hit the fan at an early age. Seeing characters, normal people, overcome and push through incredibly difficult and terrifying circumstances was comforting to me on a subconscious level, no doubt, even as a 5-year-old. And I think that's one of the reasons that I'm really drawn to Super 8. So I'm gonna sort of direct this question back to you then. When the alien, in the climax, when we see the alien, we have this big confrontation with him. He's holding Joe in his claw in the third act. And Joe looks at him and says, "Bad things happen. I know bad things happen, but you can still live." So this movie seems to have a lot to say about healing that is brought about by forgiveness, as well as moving forward through tragedy. Can you unpack some of that a little bit for us?
Sure. I mean, I think that is the central scene in the entire film. Over at Feelin' Film, that's one of our segments, is we pick out the number one most impactful scene in the entire film. Like, if we were going to sum up the film in one moment, for this movie, to me, that's what this scene is. Yeah. Because it's the emotional climax, and it's the whole time, you don't just have Joe. Joe is working through this tragedy. Mm-hmm. Joe's lost his mother. His father is not connected with him. His father is also working through the tragedy of losing his wife, and he doesn't know how to handle it. He doesn't know how to. Alice, her dad, has dealing with the tragedy and the loss, the guilt of having, been the one that was responsible for this in some sort of way, because he wasn't at work that day and the mom took his shift. So he's working through it and not doing well at it. He's also dealing with previous pain because his wife walked out, on he and his daughter. So yeah. There is so much connective tissue between all of the different families in the main families, the two main families in this film, that like everyone is dealing with kind of the same thing and nobody quite knows how to deal with it. And they're struggling. And so, when Joe uses the line and he seems to have that revelation of bad things happen, but you can still live, it immediately made me think about, forgiveness and healing and the fact that, the Bible tells us over and over that healing comes after the forgiveness. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't come before. You don't heal from the pain and then decide, oh, okay, cool, now I can forgive you. It's not what forgiveness is. It's not how it works. And so it reminded me of that. And it also reminded me of Job in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Just the idea that, you know, you can go through this immense suffering. And we all, this is something that, you know, as a Spielberg thing, as a storytelling device, like you said, that can help you get through something like your parents' divorce, as it did you, because we can all relate to what Joe is saying at this point, because it doesn't have to be us having lost a parent. It could be anything going on in our lives that is incredibly tragic or incredibly painful to us. And the message here is that, you know what? We can still live through this. There is a reason. There is more to this life is another part of what he's getting at here. And so while he's not necessarily pointing his hand in the sky and saying, you need to get Jesus, mm-hmm. you know, alien, as Christians, that's what we know to be true. And that's where we can always go back to and know that that's where our hope lies. No matter what, bad things are going to happen to us as Christians. You know, we may face persecution. We may face death, but we can still live eternally. So that's what I took out of it as a Christian, as a Christian viewer. And I think that, you know, even non-Christian viewers can take something out of that and really see something spiritual without even knowing it.
And it's this idea that the very people Christ said, I did not come to call the healthy, but to call the sick. And so a lot of these Spielberg or Spielberg-y movies focus on people who are maybe a little bit, they're not completely outcast, but they're kind of on the edges of society. They're the people we would tend to overlook, who we wouldn't take a second glance at, right? Or sometimes they are people who are mistreated and misunderstood, like we have the alien here, who has just been abused and tortured and chased all over the place. And Christ came to call the weak and the despised, right? And I love that moment at the end of the film where his mother's locket or little watch that he carries with him starts to go off toward the spaceship. And he's holding on to it, and you see him holding on to it, and he finally has to let it go, let it drift off. And so, of course, something like that's not terribly clever. It's not terribly subtle. But it works. It works for me, at least.
It does. It does, especially when you consider the tie there between him and the monster, or him and the alien,
yeah.
You know, as kind of these reflections of each other in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned, to kind of wrap us up here, you said that this is, I forget exactly how you put it, but you said something to the effect of, this is the best Spielberg film we've gotten a long time. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. What do you think makes it so? Why is this the best Spielberg film we've seen in a while?
Well, I think it has a special quality of being able to, you know, again, marry these two different directors, these two different brilliant minds, and the way that they tell stories together into a blend that we don't get very often. And, you know, it's great that you mentioned the meta aspect, because I too absolutely love that. And I think that it enhances the film a lot. One of my favorite things about this movie, believe it or not, is seeing the movie at the end during the end credits.
Yes.
Like, I don't know that I've ever been as engaged in an end credit sequence. Like, I mean, I've been engaged in post credit scenes, but for an end credits to actually show that, watching that short film is incredible. Like, it is awesome. And it hits you. This movie hits you on so many different levels, on the fun factor, the awe factor. It hits you when the train crash is happening. You're just like, did Michael Bay, looking for Michael Bay's credit somewhere? You know, like, I mean, we have these tracking shots of the kids on a hill overlooking the wreckage that are just amazing and epic. And you get so much deep emotional storytelling. It made me almost, you know, tear up at times. It made mm-hmm. me laugh out loud multiple times. The dialogue between the kids is just top notch. It's fantastic dialogue. And it wraps it all up, you know, in a nice, it's got a monster, fun, cool sci-fi element to it, or alien element to it. And then it wraps it up with a good message and a feel good, you know, takeaway. And so I think that I like it more after talking about it with you, to be honest. It's like it's growing even more now, the more mm-hmm. I can discuss it like this. So yeah, it's a great movie. It is a classic.
It really is. And I, like I said, big Spielberg fan, but I completely agree with you. Spielberg hasn't filled me with the sense of wonder and awe and amazement and excitement and just delight in a while. This is the best Spielberg movie I have seen in quite a while. At least the best Spielberg film that's in that sort of kid-centered adventure genre.
Yeah, since Jurassic Park, probably. Yeah.
Yep, definitely. So it was great to have you on. This has been a lot of fun. You do your own podcast, Feelin' Film. So why don't you plug that and tell us where else we can follow you on social media?
Thanks, man. So Feelin' Film, we just try to hold an Ephesians 4:29 message of, you know, letting everything that's good come out of our mouth. And we try to apply that to the film. There's a lot of negativity going on out there, and so we try to keep it positive as much as possible and focus on those elements of a story. You can find it Twitter, Facebook, Feelin' Film, FeelinFilm, feelinfilm.com. It's on YouTube now. I mean, it's everywhere. You can find us. Just type it in to Google and we'll be there. You can interact with me anywhere online as well. I'm pretty much Aaron L. White, AaronElWhite, everywhere you can imagine, on Twitter, Facebook, et cetera. And then I'm also in the Real World Theology group. Love to chat, love to argue, love to debate. I'm just stoked to be able to have this time to talk with you, Blaine, and I'm really gracious for the opportunity.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on. And I would say to all of our listeners, do give Feelin' Film a listen. One of the things I really enjoy about what you guys do is that, like you said, the sort of critic sphere, and I've been guilty of this as well, it's so easy to get down on movies and just trash talk them all the time. And you guys are so positive, and it's refreshing to listen to a podcast where it's encouraging and uplifting, and you guys are so positive, and you're able to just remind us that we can have fun at the movies. So make sure you give them a listen. You can follow me on Twitter @DEPT_of_tourism. You can check out what I write at Real World Theology, and I also write for Christ and Pop Culture, so you can look me up there. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks so much for rewinding with us. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!